Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 104, where we will discuss a book chapter by Arthur L. Stinchcomb titled Social Structure in Organizations, published in the Handbook of Organizations in 1965 by Rand McNally and edited by James March. This is part one of the episode where we will examine Stinchcomb's argument that the study of organizations needs to expand to include social structures and how societies impacted organizational forms. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm Rohan from London.
Hi, I'm Tom from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
And this is Pedro coming to you today from California. And it's also my pleasure to introduce to you all Shelby Guy, who is an assistant professor of management at Michigan State University. Shelby is an expert both in organizational theory and strategy, and looks at topics such as corporate governance, strategic goals, and how boards are designed. And to join us today in discussing this very interesting text by Stinchcomb on the social structure and organizations. Welcome, Shelby.
Hi, everyone. My name is Shelby Guy, calling in from East Lansing, Michigan in the United States. Very happy to be here. Thank you for having me. So it has been a while since I read Stinchcomb's essay, but one of the great features about it is really sort of getting back to the idea of how this earlier work informed so many of our existing theories today. I know that in a previous podcast, we talked about how sometimes these works can be quite impenetrable. It seems like you're entering into a conversation midstream, but returning to Stinchcomb as sort of one of the foundational works really allows us to see what was it like in the before times, before these conversations got started, and what are the inspirations behind that. So one of the things that I found fascinating about this essay is that even though it's an essay, it's not a very long book, it still sets the agenda for a lot of research questions that we find few theories sort of explaining. So one of the main premise of the book talks about what is the role of the environment in sort of structuring an organization, and how does the organization then potentially influence the environment? The idea being that before Stinchcomb, before this essay, a lot of focus on organizations considered them a self-contained unitary force. And with Stinchcomb's essay, the focus then is on the environment, that organizations are socially situated and can be influenced both in rational and irrational ways by the environment that they're in. So there were five basic points that he really emphasized. The first two, I think, are the points that he is most famous or at least well-cited about, right? So the first one, talking about the effect of environment on the rate of new organizations. Why is it that new organizations emerge? What factors contribute to their emergence and their continued success? And the second major point was talking about imprinting. Why is it that organizations at different time periods look drastically different? And in addition to that, why is it that these differences are allowed to sort of persist over time in spite of changes happening outside in the environment? Now, the other three premises, which have garnered a little bit less attention, but are nevertheless still very important, and talk about the use of violence and sort of competition in the political arena, right? So how is it that there are different kinds of turmoil and combativeness, essentially, that's happening out in the environment that can shape the way that organizations look like? In addition to that, the fourth topic talks about the organizational effect on class relationships, right? So how is it that we have this kind of social stratification that's happening within the environment? How is that going to play out within the organization? And finally, this idea of the organizational effect on the sense of solidarity and identity, especially given the heterogeneous mix of groups that exist in society. How can these different types of members from these different groups come together with an organization and share a sense of we-ness, us-ness, a sense of community and commonality there? So Stinchcomb acknowledges that this is not meant to delve into any particular topic very deeply, but to really sort of put forth questions that we have, right? And acknowledge the fact that research at that point was quite limited in terms of the answers that they can provide, but that he was hopeful that after putting these questions out, researchers can sort of delve into these questions and provide answers and greater understanding. To the extent that we have answers now, you know, more than 50 years after the publication of this essay, remains to be discussed. But I think that it's such a great starting point for us to really understand one of the classics in our field and how it is that this has inspired so many of our theories and research questions going forward.
Yeah, thanks. And for me, it brings up a big topic about why, for example, changing organizations, especially organizations that know that they are stuck in a bureaucratic age, have such incredible difficulty getting out of or transforming away from that model. This article just really paints that picture of just how much the formative period really defines structures within the organization that are just simply difficult to uproot. I had not read this before. This was the first time in which I've read Stinchcomb, and it was really eye-opening because in other aspects of communicating and leading organizational change efforts, it presents one of the biggest barriers that I run into and that others in my field have run into is why can't we obviously break what doesn't work anymore? Well, here's one very clear reason why.
To go back a little bit to what Shelby was saying and, you know, going back to you, Tom, as well, I think what is interesting in the context of what Stinchcomb was trying to do is that he was paying attention to the environment, but paying attention to society, right? He talked about, you know, it's the essay says social structure, but he's a sociologist. He's trying to understand the social patterns, values, norms, arrangements that make the social fabric. And he does two moves with that, right? Because he does one move in trying to move away from this idea of form organizations as just an ideotype, as a fixed form, and look at the different elements and variables and components and how they are arranged and rearranged and formed in a particular way, given what is the available elements, so to speak, in the as resources, as parts, right, to draw from society. And one of the things that's interesting is that he identifies some of the elements that, for example, HR organization needs to draw on when it's formed, capital, wealth, legitimacy, right, talks about the different ways in which inertia is tucked in, as you were saying, Tom, and points that there is a social basis that in a particular historical moment, in a particular setting, given the particular arrangement between classes, the prevailing ideologies, the different way in which the available type of labor, the different ways of relations between higher education, the political system, all of this, in a way, is a form of ecosystem, so to speak, that has a bearing into the organization. So it's not just about responding, it's not just about general unidentifiable resources, but it's almost like a social historical view into the context in which organizations operate, or in this case, in particular, how they emerge and what characteristics they take on.
Yeah, what I really appreciated about Stinchcomb, and I hadn't read this, but I've come across him in the realm of historical methods in management organization studies as well. And so you could see his historicism in the sense that when he talks about correlation between age and structure, an ahistorical view of that would just mean that, let's say, 50-year-old organizations look similar, 10-year-old organizations look similar. But Stinchcomb's point is you could be a 50-year-old organization that started in 2000 during the dot-com bubble, or you could be a 50-year-old organization that started in 50s in the, you know, post-World War II era. And those are two very different things. No matter, you might have the same size, scale, scope, tenure, or age, but there's a kind of a historicism to when you started. And then, like Shelby pointed out, that's kind of where the whole concept of imprinting then takes that further as well. So I really liked how he, while making a kind of structural classic argument from sociology of that time, he also keeps it quite kind of there's a historical consciousness to it, essentially.
Yeah, I think we can delve in a little bit further there, because I think it was a useful exercise to think how he presented that history as compared to what we covered in some other episodes that covered a similar history, like Chandler. You know, Chandler obviously was trying to look at the emergence of middle management, for example, as an organizational form in the context of how industry changed over time. And he looked at a lot of the same further back history. And here in just a couple of short pages, I actually should back up a second. There are a couple of different versions of this chapter that are out there, and I think we read different versions. So one of them is the one that I have. It's a reprint that appeared in Advances in Strategic Management, which perhaps is a little bit of a shorter version than the original 1965 version. In this one, the table that has the characteristic of the labor force of industries classified by age, ages in the age of the industry, he shows progression, again, over time, as Rowan said, but also based on the dominant labor market paradigm that existed, which went from unpaid family workers to self-employed and family workers to administrative workers to professionals, which is the same breakdown that Chandler provides. But here, what he's trying to show is the degree to which the change shifted across different industries from pre-factory to early 19th century to what was modern, which would have been up to 1965. It's very clear how it just progressed over time. Yet you have a mode of which ones were formed in a particular window, but other organizational forms were still appearing. And so it is important to think of these as sort of snapshots in time, as opposed to, well, yeah, exactly as was said, just because it was 1950s means it was this form. No, it wasn't. It is a way of thinking through the distribution of the organizations that formed per period, per industry, and looking at general patterns and trends. So it really does require a lot more nuanced thought about what the history tells us. God, I hope that made sense.
That definitely made sense. And what got me really excited in reading through that section was really this idea of, okay, well, now we see where population ecology got a lot of sort of potential insight from, right? The idea is that there is that element of competition among firms. There is this idea of there are many different forms that are available, but certain ones went out and certain ones don't, right? That whole adage of history is written by the victors really plays out in this section quite perfectly, right? Because to your point, Tom, it's not just like, oh, in the 1950s, everything looked like this and there was no deviance, right? No, in the 1950s, there was a distribution of different forms. Certain ones won out and they become sort of ideal types, prototypes, exemplars, whatever kind of adjective you want to use to describe it. And for simplification, right, we can sort of use that as exemplars. But we need to understand that organizations can look very different depending on the environment, and that the degree to which the environment is going to impact their form is going to vary tremendously. And so instead of trying to homogenize history and homogenize our understanding of organizations, let's delve into those nuances, right? It's trickier, it's a lot more complicated, but understanding that kind of variance and heterogeneity is key to getting a fuller, more vivid picture of organizations that we study.
So one of the interesting things about reading the classics, I feel, is that sometimes we use and see many concepts used in the literature, and then we go back to the source and we realize that whatever the paper is, or the essay is cited for, of course, was there, but it was in a particular way, right? And of course, each new reading offers a new perspective. And as conversations evolve, a concept, an idea starts to be understood in a particular way, right? So somewhat what we have been saying has to do with the rate in which new organizations emerge. How do they endure? Right, ideas related to population ecology. And one of the concepts that is discussed by Sinchcom and others is this idea of the liability of newness, that I have always, from reading secondhand, understood in a particular way. But as we are saying, by looking at the history, by looking at what the attention Sinchcom is looking and paying to labor, to the different elements in the formation of organizations, made me see it in a slightly different way. Right, so I thought that maybe we can explore a little bit more that idea. And I will start. I think what is interesting in Randy Sitchcom in the original brings is that new organizations often fail, that new forms almost have to prove themselves, right? Because they're a new way to resolve any kind of challenge and achieve a particular goal. But also he talks about what is the disadvantage, right? And has to do with how new roles needs to be learned, on how when you create a new structure in which the relations between them is not necessarily transparent or people are not used to them, they might create confusion. Right? They may put people that are not used to interacting with each other in a particular relationship, right? So there might not be trust among strangers, as he says. The clients of the organization might not be the same. So the expectations of the, I'm saying clients, but any kind of audience involved on the products that the organization produces may have different expectations, right? So they're all things that are not just the raw structure, so to speak, that exists, but the expectations around that, the way people perform such roles, the way we have almost like a social tacit knowledge in how to perform the work and to take the products of the organization that a new organization may challenge, right? And that creates one of the first level of the challenge of the liability, so to speak, of a new form of organization.
I did like the term liability of newness. It took me a couple of reads to really understand what it was referring to, because usually I think of liability of oldness. You know, you think of the opposite. These old forms, so, you know, we need something that's going to be new, exciting, energetic, or whatever. But yeah, those four characteristics that you mentioned, Pedro, they made sense back then, and they certainly make sense now as different ways in which new organizations try to leverage changes in the environment and take new forms and try to shake things up, perhaps. And when I look at the first one, for example, and I'll just read the statement verbatim. New organizations, especially new types of organizations, generally involve new roles which have to be learned. In old organizations, former occupants of roles can teach their successors, communicating not only what skills, but also decision criteria, responsibilities to various people who have relations to the role occupant, etc. So I really appreciate is, you know, how he shows, how Stinchcomb shows just what the ground is that's being paved. What is it that a new organization is going to be that is different from the old? And it doesn't take very much to think of, okay, now this is what I have seen from new organizations. And this is precisely the barrier that it ran up against. Because a lot of times, you know, in my area of work, in a large government organization, there is a lot of attempts to make new forms of organization. And the problem is, you always run into like an interface problem with the rest of the enterprise. How does this organization do this new fangled thing when nobody knows how to talk to it? This is not just the four paths that the road that the new organizations have to pave. But also, these are the sources of the very barriers upon which that the new organization is going to face. It's I found that very interesting.
As a sociologist, I couldn't agree with you more. One of the reasons why I love sociology as a discipline and why it's so easy to put econ as sort of our enemy, quote unquote, right? Or like our something to reflect back on is because they sort of try to explain away all of these inefficiencies, right? Let's assume perfect rationality. Let's assume that things can just be easily adopted, right? And you can't, right? The assumptions go to the core of our human nature, go to the core of how organizations and large groups of people function. And that's what makes it frustrating, but so beautiful, right? So this idea that we think of tabula rasa as this wonderful thing, except in the case of organizations, is something that didn't seem to have entered people's consciousness, right? And as an institutionalist in particular, that made me so excited because one of the core things about institutional theory, which, you know, his other premises can get to, is this idea of taking for grantedness, right? We see organizations that they've been there for a very long time. We sort of take it for granted that people know what they're supposed to be doing, that there are certain roles in place, and everything sort of flows very seamlessly. But when you have a new organization coming in, and especially a new organization that has a different form or structure or different kinds of dynamics within it, things aren't taken for granted because there's no thing there, right? You have to create those new routines, those new roles, et cetera. And in trying to make the implicit explicit, right? That's when we get to a better understanding of the mechanisms behind social functions, behind these social dynamics, and what is it that allows certain organizations to not just survive that time period, but thrive in later time periods as well.
Yeah, and I guess just to add another layer to that. So I agree with all of you in the sense that I found that I was aware of it just as a phrase, liability of newness, and I associated it with Stinchcomb, but it's the first time actually reading about it, and I found it quite compelling. But there's a second layer there that sometimes gets lost, partially because it's so compelling, even just at face value. But Stinchcomb, for each of those four elements of the liability, also links it to his project of linking all of this to social structure and to societal features. And so the liability of newness gets worsened or attenuated based on features of the society where that new organizational form is trying to take place. So for example, to the extent that older organizations have the benefits of trust and long-standing relationships, if the new organization is in a society where there is more impersonal trust, more institutionalized trust, it will face a lesser liability of newness compared to an organization that's in a society where trust is very much based on relationships and interpersonal kind of patterns of interaction. And so Stinchcombe then goes ahead and for each of those elements brings in a social structure factor. Again, remembering the fact that for him, social structure means societal features.
It's interesting because I thought we were going to take a historical perspective, Raheem, not to typecast you, because I think that we appreciate a little bit of that when we start to think in comparative terms. And it can be historical or just, you know, around the world, around different settings. Because I think that is making very clear that stuff that we take for granted, to go back to what Shelby was saying, right? The way people are paid, the attitude towards how much leeway you have in performing your job, with whom do you interact? How do you take orders? You know, he talks about bureaucratization, but this has to be constructed and it has to be maintained and exists in particular ways in different places, right? And didn't exist, you know, just to go back to what you're saying, this idea of impersonality, taking orders for someone not based on kinship, not based on social ties, but the performance and the position on the role, right? These things emerge at some point in time and exist in different ways around the world. So I think that we are able to see that what you're saying, right? You know, the fit between the type of organization and the context in which your organization is operating, right, is going to depend on what is that is prevalent or not in that situation.
And then, well, first, you're right, Pedro, I should have thought of the comparative historical thing, and I'm happy to be typecast as such. But yeah, the next interesting question then becomes, when you look kind of cross comparatively, becomes what happens as you start working across social structure. So what are the boundaries of social structure or of society, you know, when you are, let's say, a firm operating solely in Minnesota versus across the US versus across the world? And what happens then to how factors of the social structure affect the organizational structure? It would have been fascinating to kind of see what Stinchcombe would have thought about that.
Yeah, that that brings up a question as to what do we mean by society? And I suspect that we might have some different takeaways in that regard, because when I think of society, sometimes I hear it as if we're talking about national societies, whereas in I sort of zoom in now towards Chandler, which was really looking at different cities or different parts of the country, even different segments within between the urban and the rural domains of a particular state, of how societal changes almost next door to each other make a difference in terms of organizing. And I think a number of these industries that he highlighted are kind of along that same line. Might have some different structures that appear what happens out in the rural domains, and how, like, for example, he mentions the railroads, how the railroads expanded across the United States. But then you also had the railroad associations, and you had the company headquarters that was its own organizational form, somewhat separate. I think there's a lot of ways in which you can take what we're talking about in terms of society. How narrow do we want to look at the context? I think the arguments still hold. And that's really my main point.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I think what you are highlighting in terms of the rural-urban divide really comes out in quite a few places within his essay. And this idea that, yeah, within a rural setting, because there are fewer sort of organizational forms vying for control, you see a lot less change that's sort of occurring, and sort of a lot simpler in terms of the organizations that kind of exist. Versus he makes a point that cities, right, urban environments, because there are so many different forms that can pop up due to a wide array of different organizations or people coming in, giving up new ideas, it sort of becomes a petri dish of experimentation that can flow out, right? So this idea then of where is it that new organizational forms can come out? Well, it sort of depends on the social context. And one of the key things about the social context is you can't create something from nothing, right? You can't create something very complex from like a very limited set of ingredients. It's very much like cooking in that way. And so the more ingredients that you have, and the more complex those ingredients can be, the flavor, right, or the dish that you're able to create, can the more complex and more flavorful that the dish can be. His main point that we have to consider the role of the environment in the creation, the maintenance of certain organizations is really talking about these specific factors out there, and that, again, you can't create something out of nothing, right? So where do those somethings come about? How is it that we can maintain those somethings to create something that's a little bit more long-lasting?
So I'm going to take this metaphor and run with it, because another element, and then maybe we can move on from this, of the liability of newness idea, at least that was surprising to me, is the ingredients, are the ingredients, meaning that it talks about power, it talks about, you know, wealth, capital, and it talks about legitimacy, or he also talks about, you know, values, morality related to legitimacy. And I think that was an interesting take because, again, it underscores the sociological foundation, right? That it's not just the ideas of an entrepreneur. It's not just the structure in very simple terms like the organization design, but who is going to work there? What kind of power relations are going to be in place? How understood is such structure and how legitimate it may be, right? So I think it was a more expansive way to think about the formation of organizations that take, you know, these big building blocks and look at them in a more, at least for me, a more expansive way versus just, you know, all you need is an idea and an office and, I don't know, some money to start, right? But understanding that these things come attached with expectations, with, yeah, I don't know, a longer trail, so to speak.
Yeah, so I think that brings us then to the next section, because he explores that. It's, you know, he calls the section developing a theory of the correlation of age and structure. And in this one, what he wanted to lay down is three questions. You know, why are organizational forms originated at different times, different at the time of their formation, which I think, you know, we've already discussed sort of the stage setting for that. And then the other two questions, which he asks, which are interesting, and he it's funny that he immediately dismisses them as unnecessary. What kind of forces internal to the dynamics of passing on an organizational tradition tend to maintain the form in more or less its original shape? And why are such traditional organizational forms not eliminated by the competition of new organizational forms? And it's funny because he spends quite a bit of time downplaying the role of tradition, or perhaps I think maybe it was more of a critique of the way that it was being presented, because people were just assuming, well, because tradition is why old forms survive, because there was no other useful explanation or no other explanation desired. But he directly confronts that. He says, if we dismiss it as tradition, we are not thinking very critically about what we're doing. So that leads into the next section. And then he starts to explore mainly that first question. Two of the fundamental problems in starting new types of organization are to concentrate sufficient resources in the hands of an innovating elite, and to recruit, train, and motivate and organize personnel in a structure that will function more or less continuously. And so this is sort of like how he starts the answer to that first question. Why do organizational forms develop at different times? Let me yield from that at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I noted the same thing as you, Tom, where he sets up those three questions and then says, you know what, if I can answer the first one, the second and third are kind of automatically taken care of. And I think that partly the reason he does that is because he adopts a pretty rational functionalist view. The way I saw those three questions, for example, is he's essentially asking, you know, if I use the term imprint, he's asking, how does the environment imprint onto the organization? Then he's asking, why is that imprint lasting over time? Why does it reproduce itself? And then third, he asks, why is that a successful model or structure? And his answer involves just suggesting that the environment, and the environment is kind of social factors, technical and economic considerations, sets up the correct solution for that time. And given that it is the correct solution or the appropriate organizational structure, as long as the conditions of work stay stable, the imprint continues. The part that I found a little less compelling is when he lumps together. So just to quote him, he says, in short, by a combination of the postulate that economic and technical conditions determine the appropriate organizational form for a given purpose, and the postulate that certain kinds of organizations could not be invented before the social structure was appropriate, we have a complete theory of this correlation of age and structure. So essentially, he's saying that once you've got your technical and economic conditions of the work, let's say it's work that requires more kind of contract labor and consulting expertise, and you've got the social conditions that allow for concepts such as consultants and freestanding experts, you've got this new structure. But he takes the social as a given, and the driving force, the determinant, really seems to be the technical conditions of the work and the economic conditions. And I found that a little less compelling, because I was a bit more curious about the social part, about how the culture evolves such that we are okay with having freestanding consultants or freelancers or something like that.
So Rowan, when you were talking about sort of his focus on the academics, the technical, right? I was like, he sounds like an economist here, right? Again, apologies to all the economists out there. You're wonderful, right? I'm just using you as a convenient punching bag right now. But it sort of left me wanting as well, where I was like, where's the political, right? Where's the contention that you talk about? Where's the fighting? Where's the conflict that can make things that are irrational continue for much longer than you would expect, right? And so his focus on just what are the factors that are out there, how can we use this to adapt it, is a very rational approach, where you're just like, you take an input and you get certain outputs here. But when you layer in the political, when you layer in sort of vested interests, right, and the three factors that Pedro was talking about of power, wealth, and legitimacy, right, these are sort of quote unquote irrational stuff, right? These are things that can be distributed in wildly unexpected ways. And as a result of certain lumps in this kind of concentration, you get lumps in terms of the types of organizations that exist. And so it's that fight that I was missing, that bite of organizations competing for certain resources. The strategy scholar in me was like, where's the competition? Where is sort of the contention that can allow us to see these factors play out in a way that's extremely not linear, not rational, but very, very fascinating.
And I think actually the text has, like any complex thinker, many things mixed together, because he himself talks about that he wants to avoid any kind of tautology of why the reason inertia goes on. And as Tom was saying, I think he was trying to indirectly criticize or point out how the current ways of understanding or explaining such process were in place back then. But at the same time, he in part falls into them again, and in part the thing resolves, right? It's always like this stumbling through that any scholarly work does. And I think to some extent, he ends up, as both, you know, Rohin and you, Shelby, are saying, relying too much on this idea that the society is fixed and, you know, a prevailing model wins, you know, recombining different elements, and then that one goes on, right? But I think what was interesting is that he talks about Selznick and he talks about traditionalizing, right? And he does that in a very indirect way, and because maybe he's just assuming that people are very familiar with TVA, which we covered in the podcast, by the way. But it's basically saying that at some point, a particular procedure, a particular tool, or a particular organizational form gets inscribed a particular value that's beyond its own use. So it becomes institutionalized in Selznick's terms. And he's using this idea to say that then ideologies form, and then this becomes, you know, reinforced and understood as the correct way to do that, the appropriate way, the important way, values, you know. So it's almost like a moralizing effect in the way we organize. So I think what he's trying to say there is, it's not necessarily that whoever survives is the most efficient, right? It's not for sure. It's not that there is no competition, but there is a conflict, to go back to what you were saying, Shelby, but that is not just in terms of raw resources, but also at the symbolic level to what appears to be the recipe to organize work in a certain way, of who should be hired and what is the role of these different people in such an organization, right? So we are talking about the emergence of consultants and knowledge work, right? So there is discursive work ideology that in a way comes to positions and frames some types of employment models, some types of career progressions as desirable, normal, or not. As some of these elements change, as we see with technological change, right? New ideologies and new ideas to justify new forms also co-emerge, right? So I think there is something of an attempt to look at that, or that's, at least that's my reading, what is happening on the text.
What I wonder is because this is almost a summary work of a bunch of things that perhaps some of the things that we're talking about that you were looking for, Shelby, may have been in the other works. I don't know Stinchcomb's catalog at all.
Well, it's funny that you bring that up, Tom, because I was sort of railing against the sort of innocuousness of his second point, but in his third point, that's not mentioned in the new edition, but it's mentioned in the original essay, talks about violence, right? When I thought violence, I'm like, woohoo, excitement, right? So things are going to happen. And he talks especially about the role of elites in sort of perpetuating this, and this idea that when you don't have a good ranking system within organizations, you're going to have a lot of fighting, and you have elites or people with like vested interests trying to lead their organization to become the best and differentiate that way. But this idea, again, that of going back to what we said before, of the original text versus sort of our understanding of that text and how that text can be reshaped sort of as years go on, there is a little bit of, you know, what is it that gets left out of the conversation? What is it that gets foregrounded instead? And I think the idea of that contention, right, and is so reflective of the time that Stinchcomb wrote this, right, in the 1960s and all the Cold War, et cetera. And it's something that hasn't been sort of as top of mind in a lot of our current sort of theorizing and our current approaches to setting organizations. And yet it should be, right? As we sort of see one of the propositions that he emphasizes is this idea of the environment being relatively stable and the organization sort of taking on elements because of the stability of environments. But our environment's quite unstable now, right? There have been major big things that have happened, cough, COVID, for example, right, that have really upset a lot of the environment, have made a lot of these changes. And, you know, it's great to read a classic, but it's also like, what are the limitations of that classic? How can then we apply sort of the learnings from that classic into our new environment, our new situation, essentially, to make better predictions and better theories about how organizations function?
I think it was interesting that you mentioned perceptions of stability. Things were not particularly stable in the 1950s, too. And it's easy to gloss over that. It's it's easy for us to look back there. But there was a lot of it started with the Korean War. We went into McCarthyism. I'm only talking about the U.S., of course, but a lot of dynamics across that decade when American bureaucracy, governmental bureaucracy, really formed was, I guess, as a stabilizing factor against all of this incredible turmoil, and we're still living with it. Sometimes I get the sense that people just kind of think that it was a deliberate or a thoughtful process. And I think one thing I can kind of take away is some degree of comfort that no, it really wasn't. It was an emergent process that got us there, and that we're still wrestling with now.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about the instability of today in perhaps part two, but I got the same feeling when I was reading this, where I took a step back and just reflected on how, let's assume we don't know whether it was more or less unstable in the 50s versus now, but at least now we know that instability is salient for whatever reasons. And so when I'm reading a theoretical project where his project is to explain stability, I just find it less interesting or compelling, because I want to read people who are trying to explain flux and change. And one example of him, his kind of more stable outlook, is when he predicts that by 2500, by the year 2500, all organizations will be organized like universities, because everything is knowledge work. And so we'll have a mix of salaried employees and contract-based experts, et cetera, et cetera. That reminded me, one of his stable outlook, and second is goes back to our earlier point as well, where he still has a bit of a technical functionalist view, where as long as it's knowledge work, this is the correct solution, rather than cultural changes over time for the same technical and economic conditions of work.
It's so crazy, right, that he says that, and especially because he cites Schumpeter and this idea of like, oh, you know, your creative destruction, all of these things. I mean, what would Art Stinchcomb say to like in the face of ChatGPT that's happening right now, and all of us being like, oh no, this ChatGPT has now become the knowledge source, right, that's writing papers and creating PowerPoints for us. You know, I appreciate his view and his boldness in trying to make these kind of predictions, and especially talking about the situation, the situational conditions that he's in right now, and trying to extrapolate into the future. But things have changed drastically, man. And it's just interesting to, again, reflect back on his predictions in contrast to sort of all the fluctuations that have happened since then.
And I think that also definitely limits how much we can extrapolate from this chapter. And he's explicit about that as well, where his project is to explain how social structure and organizations influence each other, but his definitions of social structure and influence and organization both explicitly contain the word stable. So by definition, he is talking about some kind of stable structures. Of course, there might be a question of degree, but some of this won't be applicable when you are in kind of an environment of flux.
So I have a devil's advocate point, maybe, because for some reason, I always look at stability, or more precisely, I have a conviction that everything is changing, of course, but it's changing at different paces, right? I always like to use the example of the tectonic plates, right? Everything is in flux, but different elements, parts, dimensions are moving in different ways and getting accommodated at different rhythms. And Tom was actually wondering about the broader portfolio of Art Stinchcomb, right? And one of the work that he cites himself, and I think is very important in his overall career, is his study about how the construction industry is organized in a craft model, right? And he was contrasting it with a bureaucratic model. The way he's talking about the bureaucratic one is this salaried employees, right? And you progress in a career system internally within an organization, or your loyalty is within that organization, and your competence and training follows your progression into the career and so on and so forth. And he says, well, in construction it's quite different, right? It's a craft model in which you belong to a craft and you move projects a lot. You know, we would call it probably an occupational type of organization, right? In which you belong to this particular, you know, social world, and you get trained in an apprenticeship model, and the career is much more lateral, moving across projects than just, you know, taking up new competences and you expanding your role into a hierarchy. I'm saying all of this to say that I think some elements of the social fabric are more stable than others, because to some extent, of course, there's change in construction, but I think many of the things that he was talking about in the 60s, in some way, is still remain. And of course, there are new ways of building construction. There are, you know, large corporations that do that, you know, but at the same time, some of the craft model still exists, right? So I'm saying all of this to say that, yes, the 50s was both a moment of flux and a lot of political instability and the emergence of new models. But some of the elements maybe that we pay attention to were maybe changing in different paces, in different ways, at different rhythms, right? I mean, I think that's just like something to take in consideration, to what is some of the assumptions maybe under the text and how it can speak. It's more or less contextually relevant to particular process and particular elements of what we may be trying to study.
To follow on what you're saying, Pedro, he summarizes that very view in the end of, what I have is page 249. It is problematic whether the advantage of new organizational forms over the old will be sufficient to destroy the old. That's kind of using the examples you gave and others that that he provides in the chapter, all kind of reinforce that conclusion. Sometimes we do talk about new displacing the old, when in reality it's more like the new potentially standing aside the old, or even the old reasserting itself in new and interesting ways.
And yeah, I mean, I guess along the lines of making sure we don't go too negative on Stinchcomb as of the last 10, 15 minutes. I know I said that the applicability might be low based on stability versus not, but it is true that if I was thinking along the lines of the multinational example I suggested and how would things be different. And it is true that a lot of what he suggests are still visible today. And an example that came to mind was Uber, where Uber in, let's say, the US and India, and in India, they have a whole cash on delivery system. So you don't need a card at all to use Uber, even though the technical conditions of work are pretty much the same, the platform kind of system. And economically, it's not just about let's say, people not having access to cards. You see this in urban areas of India as well. It's more to do with the cultural factor where there's less of a trust system. So, for example, my parents have never uploaded a card onto an app. But because of that, the org structure changes significantly. Now, if you're doing cash on delivery, you need a whole system of collecting the cash from the drivers, accumulating it, consolidating it, reconciling it with your bank statements, etc., as an organization. And that's a perfect example of the kind of a comparative view in today in the 21st century of how different social structures lead to different organizational structures.
I guess the final point I'd like to make was just this idea of echoing Rohan's point, right, that we're not trying to dump on Archdinchcombe, right, and just level critique after critique. It is a product of its time, and I think it was very transformative because, again, of its point that organizations are influenced by the environment. That's something that we in the 21st century have often sort of taken for granted, right? Of like, of course, environment's going to be a reflection there. But at that time, no, right? It wasn't as prevalent. There weren't a lot of studies done. There wasn't a lot of attention being paid there. And so his sort of call to arms in the form of this essay is extremely admirable. And even though we're sort of pointing out the differences of conditions when he was writing the essay in the 1960s versus now in the 21st century, the foundation that he set is still something that we're playing on, right? And we're still sort of accepting some of his premises that we should be studying these kind of interrelationships. And to the extent that, you know, we're shifting between focusing on stability versus instability, right? This is just Barley and Kunda, right? Our focus is going to shift over time, but what is old is new now. To throw in a Game of Thrones reference, right? What is dead may never die, right? So to the extent that we're still talking about this about stability in certain contexts, to Pedro's point, instability in other points, it allows for us to do that both and situation, right? We can study stability and study instances of instability. We can study how the liability of newness is a plus and also focus on the liabilities of oldness, right, in other kind of contexts. But without those building blocks, without this essay, we wouldn't even have the ideas, the constructs, the words to be able to have these kind of conversations. So thank you, Art, for having written this, right? It's certainly been very educational and foundational to so many different theories that we've brought up.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.